Bike Pollution News, October 2023, the Permanoon Superhighway. We have a very fun panel for you today, including Ziz Knight of the newly formed Los Angeles County chapter of Dark Sky International, and the deep sky photography master himself, Mr. Drew Evans. This month, are we talking about light pollution all wrong? What is a dark sky resort, and is it a good thing? Bird migration is in full swing. What is your community doing to help birds safely pass through? And is environmental justice really a thing with regards to light pollution? Let's get started. It's time for another Light Pollution News. All this and much, much more coming right up. Welcome you home to another Light Pollution News. I'm your host, Bill McGeaney. Very excited about this month's show. We have another good one here. And today I'm joined by what I think may be one of the most fun panels to date. It's an all Pacific time zone panel this month. Joining all the way from Los Angeles, California, I'd like to welcome Ziz Knight. Ziz, you recently had some big news. You created the Dark Sky International LA County chapter this past March. Was there something specific that inspired you to do that?
First, thank you for having me on here. And this is going to be really exciting. But yeah, I joined Dark Sky International, formerly the IDA, in March 2023. And when I was looking for a chapter or something to do as an advocate, I couldn't find one. I was very shocked to see that LA did not have a chapter at the DSI. So got in contact with a fellow resident of LA, Anna Josenhunt, and we decided to start the chapter. Yeah.
Ziz, how big is LA County? Does that stretch all the way out to Joshua Tree?
Not quite. I don't know off the top of my head like how large or the population size of LA County is, but it's substantial.
I would imagine population there is probably absurd. Mm-hmm. We'll get into that a little bit, I'm sure, but yeah, a lot of people.
Well, on the other end, alongside Ziz, we have the very accomplished Asher photographer. And I'm hoping, Drew, that you're a dedicated Phils fan. You know, we picked up the wild card series tickets last week. Very excited. By the time this airs, hopefully the excitement will still be going on. But yeah, welcome to the show, Drew. Drew Evans.
Let's hope. Go Phils. Thank you. I'm honored to be part of the show. Obviously, coming from Philly, a big Phils fan, big Eagles fan. Flyers fan, especially. My daughter plays hockey locally here in Flagstaff and down the valley. But yeah, honored to be part of the show. I think we have a lot to talk about. Long story short, we did move from Philadelphia 4 years ago, coming up really just to get away from, as I mentioned, is the population, you know, the night skies, of course, and really to help my passion with astrophotography. And we are absolutely loving it here in Northern Arizona.
Yeah. Wow. So you moved like 7 magnitudes of Bortles.
Yeah, I don't know if the range is on the chart there, but yeah, we went from Bortle 7, Bortle 8. We were actually just north of Philadelphia in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. The light dome facing south for us in Bucks County was absurd. It really, there's a small percentage of the zenith, you know, you can look at to see some stars, you know, maybe a dozen on a great night with a new moon, to thousands here in Northern Arizona. So we went from a Bortle 7, 8 to a Bortle 2 of about 10, 15 minutes south of a Bortle 1, which is absolutely incredible if you've ever seen stars like that.
Yeah, I don't know if I have. That's absurd. Drew, you first started doing photography with a Canon Rebel.
Mm-hmm. Many years ago.
What model?
It was a Canon 350, I believe, unmodified. So once I got a little casual, I was probably in my early 20s. And the 350 was modified eventually to an IR screen to it, and really just helped with astrophotography. But it was a kind of, you know, everyday camera with a 350 Canon and the digital Rebel. Of course, everybody was using them at the time. It's come a long way, to say the least.
Yeah, it definitely has. Definitely has. I'm personally myself, I'm like at your level, 2004, 2005, somewhere in that range. You know, like I have a 60 that I use. So, which is my workhorse. That's what my daily, everyday camera is.
Yeah, the 60 is a great camera. The 60 DA, I know, they kind of did a little modification to the 60 for raster photography. I actually used that a few times many years ago. It's a great, I'm not sure if it's APS-C or full frame, but it's a great camera for Astro.
Yeah, no, it's full frame. Yep.
Fantastic. Yeah, so that serves kind of both purposes. You could use it both daytime and nighttime. But yeah, I think that's where I started in throughout the many years. I'm still learning, still graduating other pieces, and it's become more of, let's see if this works for a couple of months. If it works, I'm holding on to it. If it doesn't, I graduate and sell that and move on to something I think can work a little better. But it was definitely a challenge on the East Coast doing Astro.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, Ziz, I don't want to leave you on the dust. Like, so
being out there,
are you a Dodgers fan out there?
Not really a sports.
Not a sports ball person? Okay.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure I know teams in LA. not so much.
Well, the football teams leave every 5 or 6 years, so it's kind of hard to keep track of them.
That's true.
Yeah, the Raiders are now in Vegas. In fact, Vegas is not getting into the sports topic too much, but yeah, Vegas is, along with Phoenix, is the two most biggest metropolitan areas coming from here.
So, Drew, can you see the glow of Vegas?
No, not at all. We're at such high elevation. Our home is a little bit over 8,000 feet elevation. We just barely see Flagstaff, which is about 45 minutes south of us. So on a cloudy night, you can see the sodium color of the light they use down there to prevent dark skies, that orange amber color. And you can just see that on the cloud cover when it's cloudy up. But nighttime, it's barely visible, the light dome of Flagstaff, which is only 45 minutes south. Vegas, I'm so glad we're nowhere near Vegas because it's like looking into a light bulb.
Yeah, it's especially with a new sphere. Was this,
yeah, I was going to ask about that sphere that's brand new. What is that? What is that called? The one in Vegas? I don't know.
You know, it's slipping my mind. I know the one that they're trying to build in London. It's just the MSG sphere, but it's the same company, Madison Square Garden, trying to put these spheres in different places. And essentially what they are is they're more, I guess, augmented reality concert experiences, right? When you go inside and... So yeah, to your point,
they just call it the sphere at the Venetian. I saw it when it was being built, but yeah, talk about absolute light pollution out of that thing. It's just one giant LED bulb, from what I understand.
Mm-hmm. Yes. The videos I've seen of it, which I will say they are quite impressive, but yeah, that is quite the bright sphere.
Have you been to Vegas?
I have. I've been to Vegas, but not recently. I don't frequent there often, but it can be the fun little trip every once in a while.
Yeah, it amazes me. My daughter plays travel hockey, like I said, and she has some trips to Vegas every season. Within a half an hour, you're going from complete desert to, wow. It just, you come down from the valley, from the mountain, and you're just in this giant light pit. it's from one extreme to the other.
Yep.
Okay. Well, how about we get started this month? So I want to start this month off with a wonderfully written essay by Lauren Colley of the Los Angeles Review of Books. Colley begins her essay citing an episode of The Simpsons, whereby Lisa, after falling in love with astronomy, takes to the streets to campaign to reduce nighttime lighting levels in Springfield. Eventually, she succeeds, forcing Mayor Quimby to shut off all of the town's streetlights. Per Colley, and in darkness, the townspeople revel in their newfound freedom. Mo and Selma kiss passionately on a park bench. Bart attempts to steal the hood ornament from Fat Tony's car, but the new arrangement doesn't last long. A surge in crime forces Mayor Quimby to turn on lights on again, this time to the highest setting called Permanoon. Quimby completely eliminates night from Springfield. The city's rhythms go haywire. Marge overworks herself. Birds begin tunneling underground. Eventually, Lisa and Bart team up to shut off the power once more, and all of Springfield gathers together to watch a meteor shower naturally light up the sky above. The gist of Colley's extensive essay is not to poke fun at light pollution as the environmental concern du jour, but rather try and ground the concept in what it is and what it isn't, in what it should strive to resolve and what it shouldn't. Colley takes shots at segmentation of what some might call the people of light versus People of Darkness. Kali also pokes at the very much beloved study by street writing advocates, New York's eerily named Project Omnipresence, which weaponized light against high crime communities housing predominantly black and brown neighborhoods. Project Omnipresence weaponized a white light equivalent to 200 car headlights. Kali recalls a telling conversation with David Smith of the UK-based insect charity Bug Life, where he lambasted the concept of dark sky places, which work for things like astronomy, but per Smith, only serve to immobilize and jeopardize insect species to the confines of dark reserves that we provide for them. I found Kali's essay to be very compelling and thoughtful. It's one of those pieces of writing which may lead everyone to identify a unique takeaway. Kali appears to be questioning our language and ideas around mitigating light pollution. So folks, help me understand, do we use a particular vernacular in talking about light pollution that detracts from accurately bringing attention to the issue?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the terms of light pollution, it's a very, I would say, ignorant subject. I think many people don't know of the problem until they're told of it, you know, especially, you know, big major cities like East Coast and West Coast. It's an issue that until it's brought up to them, no reason by their own, but they're very ignorant to the fact. And there's certain terms we can introduce to them that'll help the cause.
One of the things that she did in her essay was she tried to look at some of the ways that we speak specifically about light pollution. And in many ways, people will talk around the issue and they won't actually talk directly about what it is and what it does and what its impact is. She mentioned specifically in regards to certain people talking about a necessity for a solitary nature, a solitary perspective. But again, that's kind of biasing the idea of the understanding of what light pollution is, because really light pollution is about impacting individuals. And when you do dark sky mitigation, you're trying to provide a place where people of all levels, of all stripes, can come and actually experience a natural night, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I will say when I was reading the article, kind of spiraled into this rabbit hole because I was doing some research, because language is super important. It can affect behaviors. And I felt that was really interesting. So I kind of spiraled down that hole of kind of looking at it. And basically, I got down to this part where I was tying together light pollution and the Western philosophies in regards to light and dark dualism and its effects on language and light pollution. So I did this whole thing like of research on philosophy and how it affected language. Yeah. Was that?
Did you
full circle on it?
Sis, were you able to find any instance where darkness was good?
Oh, yeah. I mean, light and dark and light being considered really like good and positive and dark as a negative thing. I mean, that is really rooted in Western, you know, ideals and nice ideologies. And there are definitely areas and cultures that really appreciate darkness. Darkness is not necessarily bad.
Or evil. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or evil. Yeah. And that's so typical that yeah, light, dark kind of fight in the States and West in general. So, but yeah, like, I mean, there's always a balance. And so this like extremes with the dualism being, you know, either this or that, there's never that in between, which most things are always on a spectrum and
one or the other. Yep.
Yeah. And it's really harmful to have such like an all or nothing kind of attitude. So when I think about the light pollution and how ingrained the idea that light is better, that it is a symbol of enlightenment, literally in the word enlightenment, and progress is compared to the dark is bad. It's going back, it's stepping back, you know, from progress. So I don't know if that ties in at all, but I really went on this interesting spiral.
Well, yeah, to your point, it seems like the phrase and the emotion and the connotations around light only apply to that pollutant, right? You don't see people talking the same way about noise. You don't see the same people talking the same way about water or some land contamination. But people, they appear to have an emotional connection to that idea of light, right?
Light and dark. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, it's just light. I mean, I can't stress enough how it is considered better and that darkness is just, you know, not desired. So I don't know.
Right? Says, why do you think that? Why do you think light is better and darkness? Is it in the phrasing that we use? When I try and do outreach, I look at the moment you say the word dark, you lose people. So I like to say starry night, which tells me and tells the other person kind of like my thought, the end goal, right? The dream, the what you're trying to achieve, a starry night. Not if you say dark night, that's going to turn a lot of people off because of the connotation you just mentioned here, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think, I mean, this roots back. I was going all the way back to like Plato and Aristotle and how like, I mean, Western philosophy is based off of that. I was looking at Descartes and the mind-body dualism, and that could be related to it. You know, this light good, dark bad, and I could probably write a paper on it. But it's just so deeply rooted that light is good, dark is bad. Like, it's prevalent in Judeo-Christian, you know, ideals and ideologies. You have light basically representing intelligence and reason, and darkness as more primal and not desired, stepping away from it. So it's hard when it's so ingrained in a culture to try to change anybody's mind when it's like always in the background of our, you know, society where, yeah, it's just that way. It can be applied to so much. The way even seeing, which is related to, you know, light, because that's how we see, is light bounces off. And that being associated with light is even seen as, well, it's, what is it, oculocentrism. So it's rooted in that as well. Like, seeing equals understanding, like, oh, I see. Or agreeing with someone is, oh, seeing eye to eye. Like, it's just so deeply ingrained that light is good and light, you know, I keep repeating the same thing, but there's just so much. And doing the like spiraling rabbit hole that I did was just the tip of the iceberg in regards to the collective consciousness of this idea. Like, we don't even think about it. I don't know. Does that make sense?
Makes perfect sense. Yep.
Yeah.
Well, let's move on a little bit here. Some little better news. I think the last article was interesting because it really got to the pieces that we don't think about, really the vernacular. But 2023 looks like the year that astrotourism actually cemented itself in pop culture. So nearly every month since we started this show, we've seen an uptick in articles showcasing tourism of some type related to night sky. And this month, the big news came out of Utah. A resort company named Under Canvas became the first resort to earn a new International Dark Sky Places designation, a dark sky resort status. Located 15 miles up from Page, Arizona, Under Canvas Lake Powell features 50 safari-style canvas tents, each furnished with West Elm decor, wood-burning stoves, and in suite bathrooms. Some even have stargazing suites with a viewing window so that you can stare at the sky for hours from the comfort of your bed. The executive director of Dark Sky International, Ruskin Hartley, believes that the new Dark Sky Resort designation will allow recognition for all levels of vacational rentals, including from the mom and pop Airbnbs all the way up to the major resorts and lodging partners. Far removed from the dry deserts of Utah and Arizona, the dark skies of Africa are becoming an interesting experiential destination for those who wish to pay for it. Why not take some of the most mesmerizing night sky objects, including the Southern Cross and Magellanic Clouds, from the spectacular Botswana Night Safari? If the safari isn't your thing, what about Europe? Why not head out to Portugal for kayaking by starlight, a dawn hot air balloon, some homegrown red wine, and even a night swim? Per National Geographic, Portugal's Alqueva region is the country's first starlight tourism destination. the region anchored by Europe's largest artificial body of water, the Alcueva Reservoir, only experienced a fraction of visitors to its neighbor, the Algarve, and offers you a star-studded view of the night sky. It's been noted from appearing last month in a line from Sense Turner's brilliant Requiem for Night Sky to this article from Upworthy, how light pollution has turned looking at the night sky into an incredible, rare luxury. That enabling fairer access to see the stars is becoming a privilege for a few. And we've spoken about this a couple times on the show. Is the dark sky resource, such as the one for Undercanvas, that Undercanvas ascertained, the right path to creating a fairer and more equitable opportunity to see for anyone to see a natural night? For further context, if you live in New York City, you have to head upwards of an hour outside of the city to a handful of state parks, which may or may not provide a natural night experience. Of course, you need a car and you need to drive an hour plus. First part might be a challenging in and of itself. I'm curious about your thoughts.
Well, initially, because what are you asking, like more equitable opportunity for anyone? I don't really think so.
Yeah. Do you see the dark sky resort designation as fitting as a way to enable more people, a more equitable approach to seeing dark skies, or is it just going to cater to, you know, luxury vacations?
Definitely the latter from my end. Go ahead.
Yeah. I was looking up all these statistics on who's going on vacation, you know, all this kind of stuff, income and PTO and everything like that, to see like who's going on vacation. And people, you know, certain groups of people are just unable to go. And I don't think labeling dark sky resort, which is amazing, like anything that we can do to, you know, have some sort of awareness, I just don't think it's going to do much for, you know, anyone, equitable or fair, regardless if it's an Airbnb, because it's just so expensive to travel. I don't know.
Drew, your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, from people who can't afford, you know, to see, you know, the night skies from inner city, even you know, suburban areas, it takes a while. Case in point, you know, when we moved out here, it took forever to even just go research where we wanted to move to the Southwest. We always wanted to be out here, but it's definitely, it sounds like, you know, these opportunities for wanting to see dark skies and the Milky Way are far beyond the reach of many.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, and the chapter, you know, here, my co-founder and I really want to start like programs to take people out to like underserved communities out to see dark skies, because they may not have the means to do so, you know, like transportation, like it says here, time. And I'm thinking more like younger people and kids to take them out.
On your point there, on the East Coast, we're talking New York City, it's not just a car rental, which depending on type of car, where you're at, it could be exorbitant depending on time of year. But you also have the tolls, right? Coming out of New York City. That's another piece of the puzzle. You got the traffic, the time. Say it may be an hour map drive, but that may take 3 hours to get out to. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's many different pieces of the puzzle that I think, to your point, a dark sky resort sounds great. And I think it's definitely going to open up more people to see, you know, a natural night. And at the other end, are we doing anything for people who have never experienced a natural night?
Yeah. And who, like the information, like if someone's going to go on vacation, who may not be able to go on vacation often, do they know that dark sky vacations exist? Like, are they aware of it? I would assume that the people who are going to it right now have access to that they're aware of it, you know?
I don't know how far the saturation has gone down, but month in, month out, we're seeing more and more and more astrotourism articles. So I would expect that to continue unless something major happens. Well, since we're on this topic of dark sky designations, we do have two new dark sky places to welcome. Exciting news out of Japan, the Minama Rokuroshi in Ono City became the first urban night sky place in Asia, and a province that has grown considerably closer to my heart over the years if only for its brilliant mountain biking trails, the tasty poutine, and incredibly delicious, well-made sour ales. Quebec's Mont Blanc National Park gains status as the sixth international dark sky place in Canada. Mont Blanc joins Mont-Mégantic, Parc du Mont-Bellevue, El Quieto Provincial Park, Bonacord up in Alberta, and the Waterton Glacier International Peace Park.
Yeah, Western Canada is absolutely incredible. Yeah. I was lucky enough to visit Vancouver and a little bit north of there about a decade ago. Absolutely stunning. And, you know, dark skies beyond that too, man. Anywhere in northern Canada, despite the cold, high altitude, really, really pristine skies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen a night in Western Canada because every time I've been up there, it's been like August or, you know, July. So not too much night to be had up there, but yeah. I'm sure.
I went to Alaska literally last year and we were in Vancouver area when we go up and I was all excited to see like a really amazing clear sky and all just super stoked. And every day was cloudy.
Yeah, that's the way it goes.
Yep.
Unfortunately.
Well, now seems like a great time to take a little quick breather. I'm so lucky to have you guys here. Got a really fun panel, Ziz Knight and Drew Evans. Before we go any further, I want to thank you at home for joining us today. Hearing back from you, the listener, is what fuels us to continue to find great, great guests and to build this show the best we can. In fact, we may have something very special for you at the end of this year, but that's neither here nor there right now. Light Pollution News is a once-a-month show where we rake the corners of the internet for news so you don't have to. In doing this, we provide you with a variety of ways to engage topics discussed here. First, if you're looking for any of the articles talked about here, look no further than lightpollutionnews.com, where you can find the extensive list of articles paired with today's narrative. Looking to stay in the know or simply prefer regular bite-sized pieces of information? Not a problem. Follow us on Instagram at light.pollution.news or follow us on LinkedIn at lightpollutionnews. I'd be remiss to mention our Reddit page, which occasionally has additional links or special items pass my way, including some behind the scenes every now and then. And that's over at r/lightpollutionnews. And finally, just announced, we're dipping our toes into YouTube. You can follow us over at Light Pollution News. Oh, I forgot to mention, while you're at our website, definitely join our mailing list right there on the front page. You'll be notified of new episodes and special episode clips. We only send out one mailing per month. That's it. We promise never to sell or distribute your email address. And Drew, as someone who works in digital marketing, I'm sure you can definitely...
Most definitely.
Vouch for the trust you need in an email list.
Treasure those lists, for sure.
Drew, I'm changing subjects here a little bit abruptly, but you may have the most impressive home observatory story setups I've ever seen. And I'm not exaggerating, folks. Drew has a roll-off observatory that many of our listeners would have dreams about. How long did it take you to assemble everything for that setup you have?
Yeah, so for the foundation, it took about 6-7 months to get up and running. Our home, of course, took a little bit over 2 years. You know, we moved from Philadelphia out here to Flagstaff, and it was the biggest challenge of my life. You know, I lost a decade of my life building our cabin out here, but you know, from finding contractors to keeping them on board to getting them up here to work, and but really was the house that was more of a struggle than the observatory. After the house was built, of course, I would really lay the foundation of where I wanted to put it. We have not dirt out here in northern Arizona, but the many volcanoes, ancient volcanoes that were on this land laid real heavy cinders. So we have a lot of cinders in the soil that really have to get leveled before any foundation is in place. So it was a challenge, you know, really from one step to the other, but about 6 to 7 months. Again, I found a really good contractor in town who built something similar just south of Flagstaff. I brought him up here north of Flagstaff where we are, and it's 18 by 18. So 18 feet, and the roll-up works excellent, so I can control completely remotely from inside the house, from anywhere with an internet connection around the world, essentially, provided there's clear skies. It rolls off. I have everything automated, so I can shoot to my heart's content and close it at the end of the night. But yeah, it's a really, really interesting piece of manufacturing and work put into it. And to have it under Portal 2 skies is incredible. I do have an old sky camera, which I will share with listeners. They can have a look at really our night skies at any time they want, daytime too. But seeing Portal 2 skies from the old sky camera is really cool to see.
Drew, how many piers do you have?
So I have three. One is more of like a wide field. I have refractors up to about 900 millimeters on the one. I have two other large ones with Ioptron CEM 120 mounts, which are very big, beefy mounts. I have a 100 millimeter SCT on one and a 2100 millimeter on the other. So one really for wide field, taking wider spans of the night sky, and the other two for really, really focused zoom, if you want to, will, you know, if you want to call it zoom telescopes for those.
Yeah. Wow. I'm shocked that you still have anything up there to look at this point.
I tell you what, me and my friends always joke around, what are we shooting next? You know, the new moon's coming up, what's the next subject? And the astro community is always very affixed on, you know, the same targets over and over and over. But I enjoy that too. I enjoy seeing what I shot last year, trying to improve on that, trying to put more hours into it, you know, just getting better data, you know, because sometimes, you know, one night session, you know, it'll start off well and you'll get very high winds or the seeing will go down. And data is so very important with collecting.
Oh, definitely. Well, this segues nicely into our next batch of articles. And I know you do a lot of deep sky objects. So have you ever used them to help promote a cause? Have you ever used any of your photos to help promote a cause, Drew?
It's a great question. I have donated some of my time here to NAU. They have Northern Arizona University. They have travelers who come up and see the Grand Canyon. And NAU likes to also talk about our night skies. So what I do is I'll go out and talk a couple hours about how to keep our night skies, how to maintain them. And I use a lot of our, again, wide field astrophotography, you know, on the smaller scopes, nothing really over 400 millimeters to show them exactly what the night sky should and continue to look like. So nothing concrete, Bill, from a concrete promotion as far as that, but just going out and demonstrating some of my photography and sharing it with our visitors here.
Well, we have this Boston area photographer, this Babak Cherveshi, who's recently showcased his photos in Boston Magazine. The article highlights some of the brilliant nighttime shots from all over New England. These are wide angle camera lens Milky Way shots. They're not going to be the deep sky stuff that Drew's talking about, even with, I presume, like a 60 or 80 millimeter, right? Right, Drew? You're having a tighter field with that.
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, 80, I think my smallest lens may go down to like a 35 millimeter Sigma lens, Sigma Art, which is great, super wide. I tend to really start around the 100 to 400. Well, I still call wide field, but yeah, his photos are excellent. I see some aurora. He uses kind of like a light display in some of his buildings. But yeah, proceed on his article.
Yeah, really nice stuff. What great stuff to help promote nighttime. The actual article is put together at the same time we see two bills making their way through the Massachusetts House, 2023 Senate Bill 2102 and House Bill 3164. Are at some stage stuck in legislative limbo. Both bills appear to lay out some common sense protections, namely barring the usual exemption, roadway lighting cannot exceed 3000 Kelvin temperature, any vanity lighting that receives public funding cannot exceed 500 lumens, and building facades along with some sports fixtures must be set up purposefully to minimize their neighborly and environmental impact. There doesn't appear to be anything odd or unexpected in either of these bills. And to the untrained eye, they look quite conservative. So now I'm going to switch over to your stasis, where Assembly Member Alex Lee is reintroducing AB 38. This is one we've been following for some time. Lee's home community, San Jose, went through a lengthy battle over the installation of electronic billboards brought about by Clear Channel in 2022. Clear Channel apparently bought its way to victory. Despite massive public opposition, the city council voted all but unanimously to approve billboards, with the two opposition votes coming from the only mayoral candidates for that term. In 2022, California Governor Gavin Newsom vetoed a proposed piece of statewide legislation on light pollution, citing fiscal constraints. Lee has since reintroduced it again in 2023.
Well, unfortunately, the bill by Alex Lee was held. Which I guess I'm not super legal savvy, but to be held, I guess it means it's dead, unfortunately. And
so it's knocked down again.
Yeah. It's they cited, you know, fiscal concerns again. And so that's really quite disappointing.
The state of California, the state that's spending billions to connect Los Angeles to San Francisco, right?
Yeah. But the positive thing is that we met with Alex Lee's legislative director, Eric King. And while talking to him, it's actually I'm quite excited because he's working on a lot of really cool stuff. He really wants Alex Lee to really lead the fight of, you know, light pollution in LA. So things are looking okay. It's, you know, not great, you know, but you think it would be relatively simple, you know, in a slow process over time to do it. But I think there's going to be really good stuff to happen in the future. Maybe this is going to light a fire under Alex.
Fire. Use the phrase light there.
Yep.
I'm curious, is California a place where you need to have a more of a local ordinance, a local community drive up, because the state level seems to be an avenue that is not possible, right? And I want to give you two examples of what's going on around the nation first. We have light pollution mitigation efforts taking place in a place like New Jersey, which isn't really known for any ecological mindfulness. The Shoreside community of Cape May is actually considering a mitigation ordinance. I should note that in addition to being a thriving shore and bayside community, the unique geographical southerly point of Cape May attracts upwards of 200,000 birds in a single day of fall migration. So what happens is birds are not expecting the landmass to just suddenly end, and they fly to the point and then circle back before gathering up the courage and make the journey across the Delaware Bay into Cape Henlopen and Delaware. And in Massachusetts, we also have some good news, and it's from the island of Nantucket. One might be described as a textbook lesson in community involvement and education. Nantucket Lights founder Gail Walker successfully worked her community to garner buy-in for local legislation that includes a 5-year ramp-up for a light shield requirement, using lighting temperatures for exterior lighting that is in alignment with the Massachusetts Medical Society standards, limits on lumen maximums for outdoor lighting, and a requirement that all necessary lighting must remain off from 11 p.m. to 6 a.m. So, Ziz, in California, is it more conducive to have a path at the local level than it is at the state level?
You know, I would think so. I feel like you need to do bottom up. So you start small and then progressively get, you know, out and out. But, you know, I'm not too politically savvy.
Point Reyes, which granted that is a little bit of a biased community because it's right by a national park. It's in more protected space. Is really the community members there are almost universally, from what I read in Esquire, appear to be on board for having a responsible lighting ordinance. However, I notice a trend with a lot of these communities is that usually it's people who are older in life that are pushing for these ordinances because they have a memory. They remember what it was like. Yeah. I don't see this from, this is just asking you as someone who, you know, your early 30s, do you think folks in their 20s and 30s would be as invigorated if there was a community, was a young community somewhere in, you name whatever place, would they be as invigorated to have an exterior lighting ordinance on the books?
Well, I feel like the younger people are a little bit, you know, they're open to change and are, you know, very aware of climate change as well and how that is affecting. So I think, yes, but the other thing is majority of my age don't own houses or have lots of control over exterior lighting, like re-rent. And so I think, yes, if they're aware of it, if they have, you know, some control over exterior lighting, they would. Yeah.
I feel your pain. I feel like I've run away from the problem, you know, on the East Coast. My wife and I found an area where we wanted to be that was dark, and, you know, the struggles continue where we left from.
But, Drew, I can see 35 stars at night. What are you talking about? It is amazing.
On a good night, right? And with a new moon. I remember, you know, even when we go back to visit family and friends, it's, you know, it's a shock. It's like, oh my God, you know, what is happening? And there's just, like I said, I think just the ignorance. I think the more, and I know Flagstaff has done a real good job of that with their ordinances, is just letting people know, you know, what will happen or what will continue to happen if, you know, if we don't preserve our skies. Yeah. Again, I feel like I run away from the problem. You know, thankfully there was an opportunity for us, but you know, I envy your work. It's something that, you know, has to continuously be spread.
Drew, mm-hmm. Drew, does your community have any kind of a night sky, dark sky ordinance?
Yes. Flagstaff was the first international dark sky city in the world. I think that was put back in the 80s. We are very, very strict on our low pressure sodium lamps. I know they use a lot of narrow spectrum amber LEDs as well throughout the city. So even when you're flying over Flagstaff at night, you'll see like an orange glow from the city, no white lights whatsoever. You know, there's a few scattering of LEDs below with car lights and whatnot, but they're extremely strict with their dark sky ordinances here. It's at times throughout the week, you'll see trucks driving around just inspecting whether people have, you know, the down shaded lamps installed properly. And, you know, it's something from the very beginning that they've always adhered to. Super proud of that, to be a member of the coalition as well.
I have a feeling that it's a lot easier to have that on the books instead of trying to convert people over.
Exactly. And that's where I think, you know, I respect Ziz's efforts. It's kind of, you know, retroactive of everything that we're trying to do here. These were in place before skies really got really right here. People adhered to them, and it's 100% more of an effort trying to retroact everything that's been done, especially with population centers.
Mm-hmm. Drew, on your point, you mentioned about flying over. So we went up to Alaska this summer, and the flight back, we actually had some hours of night. And we flew back red eye out to Minneapolis. And it was probably one of the coolest flights I've ever seen in my life, because going over to Rockies, there was no light coming from the ground. And you could see a brilliant Milky Way out the window. And I've never seen that ever on a plane. And it was pretty astounding. Yeah, it was pretty cool.
the mountains, I'll tell you what, even flying from, you know, the short puddle hopper flight from Phoenix to Flagstaff, we've done that a few times. The mountains, kind of like, the skies are so dark, you don't even see the horizon. So the mountains you'll see on the horizon are very dim. And then, you know, you go right into black sky. But it's, especially from elevation, you know, it's a really cool sight to see.
Well, before we depart from our policy segment, I'm curious to hear your guys' thoughts on this one. This is interesting. Should Greenwich, Connecticut ban exterior landscape lighting under the guise of protecting birds? New regulations are being considered replacing outdoor guidance dating back to 1993. The proposed code aims to reduce total business lumen output by 30% or have them turned off completely an hour past closing time or after 10 p.m. An extension of the code will prohibit landscape lighting, drawing from the unified ire of business owners and ostentatious residents alike. Is this overreach? Isn't it one thing to say, like, you have a common sense framework for eliminating upward lighting, but is it okay to curtail purposeless vanity lighting, which people seem to love, such as lights pointlessly focused on trees, flower beds, side of your not nearly as attractive as you think it is white stucco house? How do you guys feel about that?
Appearance, you know, obviously people are going to do the best for curb appeal in their homes or businesses or whatnot, but to the effect of it, you know, interfering with bird migration, and I think it's a wise call. I think there's little steps that can be taken prior to that. You know, just turn the lights facing down. You know, they don't have to be facing into trees, into the sky. Certainly you're not illuminating anything more than, you know, your buildings. So there's little steps, I think, instead of jumping into removing all lights completely, there's little steps that can be done, like downward pointing, you know, the shrouds on top of lighting, instead of going to that extreme of removing them all completely.
What about the glow?
The types of bulbs too. Yeah,
What about the glow, you know, Drew? You're going to ruin the glow.
The types of bulbs as well. You know, there's amber LEDs that illuminate around our house. You know, we replace all with amber LEDs that are kind of like a reddish color. They don't kill your night vision. They don't interrupt the birds. Insects too, but there's little steps that can be taken before really jumping in with both feet.
Well, I will say this. My apartment complex just redid all of its lighting, and it's now shining up to highlight the trees, which already is not a great thing for trees and is just extraordinarily bright. So it's not great. And I feel like for businesses and landscaping, like, who's looking at your building or landscaping at night? Like, what is that for? You know, I think you can probably turn it off and, you know, later in the evening, because nobody's out to be, you know, shopping or whatever, or cares what your house looks like.
Do you use social media, I assume, right, sis?
You know, I'm not really a social media savvy. I kind of don't do much. But so yeah.
Ziz, isn't that the appeal though? Is just like you have social media, you kind of want to create this artificial magical landscape. You want to have it look pretty, you know, we want to have it look in a way that is very attractive and lures someone in and makes it look kind of, you know, like a little bit like Disneyland. Isn't that the appeal? Isn't that what people want to see?
Well, yeah. I mean, I feel like that's totally fine, but you can turn it off after a period where not a lot of people are out and about to admire your landscaping or, you know, building. Like, have it for X amount of time, have, you know, appropriate, responsible lighting, and then, you know, dim it down or something like that. You know, I just don't think it needs to be on all night.
You know? Yeah. And there's, like I said, too, there's methods of reducing the lighting as well. You know, the types of bulbs that are used, where they're directed, and, you know, like you said, the timing.
Mm-hmm. Is there a more responsible way to make your yard look like, you know, I don't know, perfectly
managed? Yeah, I think we had back in PA, you know, in Bucks County, we had landscape laying at our house. You know, went on at dusk and it shut off at midnight, and, you know, I angled it down. You know, there's no reason to have lights just pointed directly up into the sky. We had shrouds and all of our ground lighting, we had tree lighting that started about halfway up the tree. So, you know, there's ways to reconcile. You know, if you want illuminated yards and businesses, there's ways to reconcile and help the night skies as well as having what you like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds great, Drew. On that note, we do have some articles out there on lightpollutionnews.com where we have suggested some certain styles and some certain fixtures, which we get no kickback on, that we do not have an affiliate with any service out there. But let's switch gears, shall we? So did you guys know that astronauts on the ISS experience 16 sunrises and sunsets per day? That's because the space station orbits the Earth every 90 minutes, combined with the strangeness of having your sky sit neatly packaged in a giant sphere below you and near a constant weightlessness. One's got to wonder, how on Earth, or more aptly, above Earth, do these folks sleep? Sega's space architects have built a lamp that they hope will help passengers be able to sync up their circadian rhythm. The lamp, which now sits in European Space Agency's Andreas Mogensen's crew cabin, glows red to simulate a calming sunset and will glow blue to evoke colors of a morning sky. Researchers at Aarhus University in Denmark are using Mogensen's as a guinea pig in what they hope will help provide a closer grasp to mitigating circadian issues in space, and possibly shed some understanding on the ones down here. A bit closer to land, we have the Percy Light Study, which attempts to measure the impact of modulated lighting on residents of a Dutch nursing home impaired by dementia. It's a 30-month study that gauges how the effectiveness of a proprietary lighting system will improve patients' mental state while also improving the condition of nurses on site, nurses who are exposed to consistent lighting on all hours of the day. And then staying in our tech theme, there's this very interesting study out of smart cities in Finland. Researchers put to the test always on streetlights versus presence sensing streetlights that trigger as vehicles approach. The results indicate that drivers were, well, pretty indifferent to either the always on or the presence sensing streetlights, meaning that the presence sensing light fixtures performed on par with the always-on fixtures in the mind of drivers. To be sure, this is an early study, so more research is needed, especially to understand how such off-on smart lights would impact pedestrians, ecology, and simply those neighbors living nearby. A very interesting set of news articles we had there. And Drew, Liz, what kind of street lighting would you prefer? Would you prefer that always-on, or would you prefer the flicking off and on depending as a car drives by?
I mean, the lighting I prefer is the responsible lighting, you know, and I think Drew knows this specs a lot better than I do on that. I just know the, you know, five principles of responsible outdoor lighting. So I don't mind it flicking on and off. I don't have a problem with that.
Yeah, I again, I'm for whatever preserves our skies. I think Flagstaff has done an exceptional job on setting an example in municipalities and cities how to follow these procedures. Like I said, the amber bulbs, the low illumination LED has worked phenomenally here. I think, you know, to keep them on all night wouldn't even be a problem as long as they're put in place effectively. You know, they're not pointing towards the sky. But it takes an army to really, really explain and go beyond that ignorance level of showing people how effective they can be. So I would stick with what works. I can even post and or share a link with you guys and show you how we're doing here in Flagstaff.
That'd be great.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Drew, because as you're in your apartment, and if the street light was going on and off all night, I think that would probably be more jarring.
Annoying.
For an individual. Right. Right. Mm-hmm. Although, why not just, if we're going to do it that way, why not just have it dimmed down? And the brightness may not be as noticeable by individuals, that change in brightness.
Yeah. And if the funny story here is when we've been in our house about a year now, first time we moved in, we had, I think, just regular orange bulbs outside, which were recommended, you know, they're dark sky friendly. So our neighbor, I guess he's about a half mile away and back, you know, gave me a text. He's like, Drew, you know, you got to find something different. Your house looks like Cracker Barrel from our windows. So what I did is I actually painted the shrouds. The shrouds were white, but they're facing down. I painted the shrouds. I took the bulbs out and I painted the inside of the shroud black, and it did a phenomenal job of non-reflecting that light even further. So it dimmed the lights even more. But funny story there, you know, we adapted to what he had, what he preferred, what he's been seeing probably the past 20 years. And again, it's all about adaptation.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, before we go any further, I want to just pause to remind you at home, if you have any thoughts, questions, ideas, or even articles you'd like to share over to us that we should know about, feel free to shoot all of that and more over to bill@lightpollutionnews.com. That's my email. Or you can message us over at Instagram at light.pollution.news. We always love to hear from you. I'd like to give our guests a chance to talk about something that they've been working on. Ziz, is there anything coming down the pipe, anything that folks may find interesting on your side?
Well, mainly just focusing really on getting the chapter rolling. That's really my focus at this point.
If someone's listening from LA, how can they go about connecting to you?
Yeah, they can email us at lacounty@darksky.org, and we'd love to hear from people who are interested. As I said, it's in its infancy, so it's kind of slow going right now, but we're creating some really good relationships with other groups. But yeah, not anything big on the horizon at this point.
Drew, anything new with you you'd like to share?
I've had a ton of data this past summer. You know, we're getting into fall now here and relatively light monsoon season. Sometimes monsoons, you know, you'll be clouded over for weeks and weeks, but August, even July, we've had some really good nights. So I have a ton of data to work with. I'll be posting a lot more pictures of some of the subjects I've been shooting astronomically. Like I said, I just got my observatory sky dome and all sky camera up and running. I'd love to get that really, you know, really fine tuned, and I'll be able to share that with everybody. But a lot of data I'm working with right now, and be on the lookout.
Joe, you made me think of something when you said monsoon season. I don't know, 10 years ago or so, I was hiking through the Sierras. And we sent back our tent. So you're like, who needs a tent in the Sierras, right? But it was monsoon season, and I think it was supposed to be like maybe a quarter of an inch total for 2 months is part of monsoon season. And it rained religiously for two straight days. And talk about some poor decision-making in the monsoon season in the Sierras, but you know, it is what it is. I'm sure you guys have a similar experience out there.
When it comes, and it's, you know, it's relentless. It'll, you know, you'll get 2 weeks of just straight rain, straight clouds, it won't go away. And then boom, overnight, you have a month of clear skies. It's pretty remarkable. This past winter, even, it was the second most snowiest winter in Flagstaff. We had over 200 inches of snow. I mean, our front door, you'd open the front door and you couldn't even get out. It was about an 8 foot drift. So when it comes, but I'll tell you what, the weather here is phenomenal. No, low humidity, 20-30%, 8,000 feet elevation, clear skies. But yeah, those monsoons will kick your rear end.
Well, let's switch over to some fluff pieces that I'd love for either of you to weigh in on. This is coming from the website, The Spruce. to list the number of followers by their social media channel at the bottom of each page. I'd like to hear your thoughts on the following from their posts. Top 10 best outdoor motion sensor lights of 2023. So on a scale of 1 to 5, with 5 being the most annoying and 1 being the most unassuming, how do you two rate the following in terms of terrifying your neighbor? First up, the Leon Light security lights showcasing 1800 lumen output with a delightful 5000 Kelvin white as your Sunday afternoon color spectrum. Bonus, per the spruce, this one has a range of 69 feet and can be aimed in a direction most likely to incur nightly intrusions. Translate directly at your neighbor's windows. And is it just me, or do these fixtures always resemble robotic faces? Maybe I'm watching too much sci-fi. Where do you guys stand? Is this a 1, 5, 3? What are we looking at? With 5 being the most annoying and 1 being the most unassuming to terrify your neighbor.
Pretty intense, I would say. 5, 4, 5.
Yeah, I'd go with the 4 or 5. I think it's absolute overkill. I mean, you know, 1800 lumens, it's like a car headlight in your neighbor's windows. Total overkill.
Next up for best and brightest is Sansi's motion floodlight. And it looks like a plane with wings set for a bombing run. On each side of the sensor, 3 perfectly unshielded LED fixtures combined for a total lumen output of 6,000. But don't worry, there's no dimmer setting for this guy. So now you can blast not just one neighbor, but even blind ones living a few houses down.
Insanity.
So we have one more I'm going to look at here. We could go on all day. This is the kind of the unique one out of the group. So I want to see where it sits on your number chart, guys. How about the Yuri Lighting EFL 130-watt MD flickering flame lantern? This fixture design harkens back to an old oil lamp flickering away with a fake flame until there's movement. Then, bam, this gotcha sending out 1,200 lumen white light in all directions. Where do we sit on that?
Well, it's not 6,000 lumens, so you know we're a little downgraded there. The amber bulb, you know, it's probably a little better than the bright white 5,000K, but still, I think it's a little overkill. It does have a nice little shroud on top, but it's still throwing light everywhere horizontally. Not a fan.
Yeah, agreed. Not a fan. I do like that it's a skeuomorph, though. You know, harkening back to lanterns and using that.
It has a nice little design, right?
Mm-hmm. It is motion detecting. It's not on all the time throughout the night. But yeah, I'm still a fan of the shrouded. I'm still a fan of the, you know, the low sodium amber light just always pushing down. It still provides enough light.
Well, enough of the bad fixtures. Let's go over to the good fixtures. Metropolis ran an article showing all 4 dark sky friendly lighting fixtures, and all 4 of them are priced high enough to be out of most people's budgets. The article showcases the apparent disconnect between dark sky friendly lighting and what the average Joe wants to spend. Many of the fixtures I see that bear the mark of Dark Sky International either aren't priced to consumers' wallets or aren't utilitarian enough for what the average consumer is looking to use it for, meaning the fixtures don't really answer the why of why you buy lights to begin with. So, Anna, Drew, maybe you're aware of some good fixtures in a local hardware store anywhere, but why are they missing a mark? What's going on?
I'll tell you what, the big thing is they're out of price point. You can see a lot of these are priced high. A lot of people aren't going to spend that extra money just to be able to, you know, to adhere to ordinances. I mean, they're great looking lights. They are approved by, you know, the IDA. There's different options. You know, you can buy a shrouded light and a cheaper bulb, which is what we did. I think they're really missing the mark based on price point.
Yeah, they definitely are. And I think until you get that price point down, people aren't going to care about having a responsible light. So let me relay a story. I was in Home Depot the other day and just happened to walk by the exterior lighting area, you know, and all the lights come on because they track you. Everything's motion. Mm-hmm. And
it was like walking into an amusement park as soon as you walk down aisle 12 of lighting, right?
Exactly, yeah. And there was only one good fixture there. Everything else is terrible. And that one good fixture really wasn't even the fixture for what people are going to use it for. You know, we're talking about floodlights where they have no shielding, much less, you know, it'd be nice if they had a little bit of shielding. They have no shielding, incredibly bright, and they're built to be aimed directly at a parallel with the wall, right? They're not built to be aimed downward in any sense of the idea. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if, you know, I see that as constantly being an issue. If you want people to, you know, go out there and install, you know, nice guy friendly fixtures for their house, and but there's nothing going on the market.
Right. I mean, you know, like getting back to price point on some of the examples you've given me, over $250, $380 for a fixture. It's literally a $20 shroud. You can buy at Home Depot or Lowe's or anywhere, and, you know, put a light for any bulb in there, put something that's, you know, that's 3000K and, you know, 20 watts, and, you know, it'll suffice.
All right. Well, let's talk some birds. It's about that time of year again. And I know some of you, well, I'm sure, came way too fast. It's fall bird migration season here in North America. Many communities participate in the Audubon's Lights Out campaign, whereby various commercial towers will dim their vanity and non-essential floor lighting to reduce the light's impact on birds passing through. In St. Louis, the National Park Service chose not to illuminate the Gateway Arch during the month of September, as St. Louis sits on the Mississippi River Flyway, which witnesses around 40% of the nation's migratory waterfowl pass through. In Texas, again, we see former First Lady and Texan by Nature founder Laura Bush come to bat for practical ecological issues, this time a Lights Out campaign. Per former First Lady, taking action now is vital because every spring and fall, between a third and a quarter of birds migrating at night through the United States travel through Texas. To hit the point home, there was a corresponding exhibit at Texas A&M showcasing light pollution's impact on birds, including the display of many birds that were killed from building collisions. It's estimated that 80% of migratory North American birds do so at night. The sheer distance birds travel, largely at night, are astounding, anywhere from 15 to 600 miles per day. And the speeds at which they do it are even more incredible, anywhere from 15 to 55 miles per day. And did you know you can even bird at night? All these details come to us from a great multi-part series by Scientific American's Science Quickly podcast. Birding at night presents some challenges. You really can't just visually identify birds. Instead, you must essentially create an audio bucket, which is exactly what it sounds like, a Lowe's bucket converted into a giant microphone. And we'll have a link to a tutorial for any of you interested. You can just go out there and you can see how you can build your own one of these over on Light Pollution News. So once you capture the audio, how on earth do you tell what kind of bird it is? Night signatures are very distinct and different from daytime chirps. Utilizing over-the-counter software, hobbyists can implement audio identification software to assist with identifying the cue. As astronomers use large arrays of visual, radio, and X-ray observatories, birders utilize what's termed nighttime bird surveillance network to distinguish individual species. These are essentially groups of nighttime audiophile bird observers. On the professional end, radar is used to forecast bird movement, aiding in predicting when precisely cities should expect bird flyovers. Through technology and citizen science, avian fans are looking to help provide a more dynamic approach to nighttime lighting policies, which will sherpa birds safely across the continent. Joe, have you ever, in any of your long-timed exposures when you're not using telescope, have you ever had birds come across to any of those photos?
Birds really aren't the issue. Even satellite trails, planes aren't the problem. There's scripts put in place when you compile all your data. Consolidate has local normalization. Say that 10 times fast. There's a script called local normalization that will remove artifacts from planes, from birds, from satellites, you name it, insects that go across the lens. But it... Tell you what, it's really cool. And I posted a live stream last night on Facebook. You'll be able to actually see birds going across the moon, back and forward flocks. But to answer your question, no, there really hasn't been any negative experience with you know, imaging from an imaging perspective on exposures.
Drew, you'll have to get those videos over to me. I'd love to point people over to see what you saw. That's great.
For sure. Yeah, I'll definitely send them over.
Well, sticking with birds, we now have greater insight in how so-called common birds handle light pollution. Per North Carolina State, robins appear to be the biggest beneficiaries of an endless daytime. Robins utilize the artificial light, much like people would, to extend their daily activities past the confines of sundown. So that means they're out there picking through the yard from whenever the lights go on to really when the lights go on. so lights are always sold. Gray catbirds and wrens, on the other hand, appear to incur the most difficulty in light-polluted environments. It's noted that a sizable number of bird collision deaths involve gray catbirds. For a study that we saw last month in the Science of Total Environment, sleep deprivation actually hinders birds. A 24/7 daytime impacts the cognitive abilities of songbirds. A little bit of the ecological impact just on birds. But let's round up the remaining ecological news that came through this month. So per the New Zealand Journal of Zoology, artificial light at night impacts how critically threatened long-tail bats behave. Using LED floodlights, researchers counted significantly lower bat detection rates on nights when the light was on versus compared to when the light was off. The control site that lacked the floodlight saw no change in bat detections over the same period. It appears that even oysters, creatures that lack eyes, have circadian rhythms thrown into a knot by persistent artificial light at night, light that doesn't even reach the level of the full moon. Per a study in June in the Marine Pollution Bulletin, when exposed to artificial light, oysters open their shells at inappropriate times. Opening of shells being an activity that's done typically midday for the purpose of everything from eating to mating. It's already known that artificial light elicits a biological response from coastal organisms spanning over the tune of 2 million square kilometers of ocean. So it shouldn't be a surprise that we have yet another article on light pollution's impact on coral reefs. Artificial light has been seen to exhaust coastal coral reefs, specifically creating more porous skeletons compared to controlled corals. In a Marine Pollution Bulletin article, light pollution alters the skeleton morphology of coral juveniles and impairs their light capture capacity. It's surmised that Allen actually erodes the daytime photosynthesis ability of corals. Staying underwater, a study from the Science of Total Environment indicates that artificial light at night also impacts the reproductive fitness of fish species. The Japanese Medica was used in this study. Evidently, Medica fish have a rigid hierarchy dominated by aggressive males. Under normal day-night cycles, subordinate males, though receiving less time with females, were able to procreate. When exposed to artificial light at night, the sperm quality of the subordinate fish actually decreased, while the dominant males continued to successfully mate. And then finally, apparently some species of plants are more susceptible to artificial light wavelengths. In a study from Ecological Processes, it's found that the bushy Japanese Euonymus experienced decreased stomata effects for light containing blue and red wavelengths. The stomata, for those of you at home have no clue what this is, essentially the pore of a plant that helps exchange gases and moisture. Meanwhile, the garden rose, which was examined side by side, was not at all affected by artificial light. Well, we still have a little bit left, friends, so don't turn away just yet. I want to thank my guests, Ziz Knight and Drew Evans. We had to start a little bit earlier than usual, Drew. Your daughter has a hockey game this afternoon. I guess she's going to crush some skulls, take them into the boards.
Thank you very much, yeah, for amending the schedule, the normal schedule. Yeah, so like I said, she plays travel hockey for a girls' elite team down in Phoenix. It's about a good 2.5-hour drive several times a week to get her on this team. But she plays goalie, so she's not crushing any skulls. She's getting pucks shot at her skull.
It takes a special person to be going.
Yeah, special parents too. But yeah, thank you for amending.
No problem.
I really appreciate this opportunity. It's fantastic to let your passion, you know, be spread to everyone else around the world.
Yes, definitely. So we typically record on Sundays, which is the towards the end of the month, and this is always one of my favorite days of the month because, you know, after pulling everything together, I get to hang out with you folks. Always some really cool folks. Always fun to talk with people like yourselves and have that experience, you know, and especially people like, you know, Los Angeles. We had a guy from Brussels. It's always fun. So if you like what you've been hearing, how about join us every month by subscribing to this show on whatever podcast player you're using? We're in this to generate conversation and awareness around light pollution. So why not share this show with your friends or maybe even your enemies if you really don't appreciate the show, but why would you have lasted this long, right? We'd love to open more folks' eyes to the issues surrounding light pollution. And if sharing isn't your thing, for low cost of price of coffee, $3, you can help us defer some of the expenses that it takes to bring you this show. Every bit goes to help us further conversations around Life Pollution to new people and new minds, and your $3 will go directly to offsetting server and production costs. Ziz, again, like, how can people get in touch with you? How can people learn more about what's going on over in LA County?
Yeah. So, you know, once again, if you're in LA County, email us at lacounty@darksky.org. If you're not in LA, head over to Dark Sky, you know, darksky.org, and become a member or an advocate or both. Like, we'd love to have people, more people.
Awesome. Awesome stuff.
Drew, how about you? Where can people find your spectacular photos?
Again, appreciate it. Outreach wherever. You can Google me. Just Google my name, Drew Evans Astro. You'll see, you know, my Astro bin, which has all the images I've taken over the years. My Instagram is on there. My Facebook is on there, et cetera. And like I said, I'm also building a dedicated website myself for my observatory, which houses the All Sky camera. Anybody can take a look at our night skies at any point in time. But yeah, reach out. I'm looking forward to hearing from anyone.
Excellent. All right. Well, I have a couple stories here that may have you thinking twice about your position on both billboards and streetlights. First up, the city of Oakland, California approves a deal with Becker Boards LLC and Outfront Foster Interstate LLC to essentially double their billboard signage. Before you grimace, the agreement between the city and the billboard companies forecasts a gross revenue of $73 million over 41 years. That flatlines to around $1.7 million per year. How exactly can you forecast out 41 years? And why on earth you're entering a 41-year contract is beyond me, but that's neither here nor there. The $1.7 million additional per year is supposedly supposed to go back to the city and to allied community organizations. Then next up, because street lighting actually makes streets safer after all. And this one comes to us from WFAB 9 down in Baton Rouge. Lack of lighting impacting city's efforts to fight crime. Yvette Wright's son, Taiwan, was shot twice on a street with no lights. Despite laying on the road, screaming and shining, his phone's light up and down. Nobody apparently noticed him. Thankfully, Taiwan was able to call 911 himself, and he did survive the attack. In another instance, a resident on the street with lights had at least one car with windows smashed in. Local residents feel that more lighting would deter such vandalism. We can take these stories one by one or ad hoc, but I'm very curious about your guys' thoughts on these two stories. In one regard, I hear time and time again that there's such a concept as discriminatory lighting, disproportionately affecting minority communities. And it's often tied to an idea of economic disadvantage. However, I see stories in the media constantly that show individuals within communities that are considered economically disadvantaged as clamoring for more lights, not less. So is it fanciful to think of light as an environmental justice issue? Should the narrative be flipped whereby such communities actually are underserved by street lighting? Then on the other end, we have our good friends and billboards. Are billboards actually good for communities? I'm curious to what you guys think.
Yeah, Liz, I'll let you lead off. This is definitely more of your realm.
Yeah, so I know when it comes to lighting that it does seem to be light pollution effects underserved communities far more, but yeah, they do tend to want more lighting because of that concept that it's safer. Another thing is like with the homeless population, they want to be, you know, under light because it's also considered safer.
Drew.
Yeah, I definitely think, you know, with the communities that need the lighting would prosper from it. But I'll get back to the point of, you know, over exceeding the amount of light. I mean, there's a cutoff point. There's the type of bulbs we use. I don't think any community should be without proper lighting. Don't get me wrong, but there's ways to enforce that lighting.
Then on the other end, I hear Dark Sky talk about an environmental justice issue around where light and light pollution affects. So Drew, what you're saying is that, hey, you know what? That's fine. We get it. You know, you need to have more light. This community just, in order to function in these, you know, it needs more light. But you're saying put in fixtures that are responsible. I guess on the other end, when brightness is the measure of safety, doesn't that negate the fixtures that are responsible? Putting in those good fixtures?
Yeah. I don't, again, I want to be a I don't want to be a pessimist, but I want to see the data like Ziz says, where, you know, that level of brightness, you know, safety has subsided by the level of brightness. I don't see that. I see brightness as brightness. And I think, you know, there's certainly not going to be any crime or suspicious activity based on the amount or the lack of brightness that's in and around the city. I'd like to see some data there. I'm a big data guy.
Well, we'll circle back if once some data. I feel like with all these conversions, we're going to have some data. I will say this. Maybe the fact that these communities that we're talking about here, if we're going to talk about an economic disadvantaged community, maybe they feel like no one's paying attention. And maybe having the light there is a sign that you are trying to at least help them with their problems. Maybe that's part of it.
Getting back to the electronic billboards, I've read a lot of articles in the past, even in LA. I think there was an article in LA a few days ago that they're really overpopulating. They're going from, you know, the regular billboards that are, you know, have the illuminated light looking down to these huge gargantuan LED bulbs, which is like the globe, you know, all up and down the freeways. Yeah. Even Comcast building, I know, Bill, the Comcast building built that ginormous spiral. Yeah. I don't know if there's a spiral or needle on the top of that thing, and that thing just points directly up into the air for no reason. I'm surprised there wasn't any feedback on that prior to building. Well, talk about bird migrations and tracking birds or insects. That thing is like a giant illuminated needle.
Well, to your point,
seeing that.
Yeah, to your point, Drew, that actually, it killed so many birds that it spurred the impetus of Lights Out and actually helped Philly become one of the leading examples of Lights Out, because Comcast didn't want to be seen as killing all these birds, but they had a huge bird kill in October of, I want to say 2020, or I think that's the year. And it was right there at the site of Comcast. So some of these downtown towers. And Comcast, for those of you at home who don't know what the building looks like, think of a giant, it's like a vape device at the one side lit up for miles to see. And Drew, Comcast just one-upped themselves, because down at the Wells Fargo Center, they decided to put massive billboards on the side of the arena itself.
Of the arena. Unbelievable. Has there been any feedback or pushback towards all this? I mean, we obviously have the data with the killing, you know, killing birds. And I just remember, you know, when we were in Bucks County, when they put that thing up in 2020, we were just moving out of Bucks County, and that feature was put up and we could see it. I mean, we were a good, 30 miles away from the city, and you could see it was a big needle in the sky, and it was just horrible to see.
Yeah, they always have to remind you of how badly they screw up your bill.
Yeah. So it's not just the night guys are screwing up services. Service is horrible, but that's another topic.
Well, we have another story here. This one comes to us from Lexington, Kentucky, and it's a different take on streetlights. It looks like taxes are rising to cover the expense of street lighting, which has exceeded budget by the tune of $2 million per year. By an 11-4 vote, Lexington will raise taxes for businesses and homeowners as streetlights have not raised enough revenue to cover expenses needed to operate streetlights for the city. That is a very strange quote if I've ever did read one. I can't imagine how a streetlight raises revenue, but sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is something where a lot of communities, when they do conversions, they try and pass it over as a crime mitigation technique to kind of soften the economic blow, because it usually sits around 1 to 2 to somewhere 2.5 million for a full LED conversion. I'm not sure if that's the same thing here in Lexington. I believe that they're actually just fixing a lot of their streetlights, but you know, that the more streetlights you have, the more you have to maintain them. And then also the more streetlights you have, and I know in San Diego, this is a big deal, the more people tap in and try and steal the electric from them. So, you know, it is what it is. So let's wrap up the news here. Dark Sky International announced winners of their annual Capture the Night photo competition. This year's winners were truly mind-blowing. The contest spanned 10 categories with some of the most well-composed photos I've ever seen, including a Wang Tianwei's brilliant Milky Way fisheye view of the Percy Amelia Shower.
Beautiful.
Yeah, spectacular. Did you see this one? Ethan Sue's astounding lily blossom foreground with the mountain lit right there in the background. And then I thought this was pretty cool. I don't know If either of you guys looked at this one, Joe Casey has composed an interesting conceptual shot showing what it would be to look to see the Milky Way out of one's bedroom. And then my personal favorite, Tengyu Kai's composition of a firefly crazy foreground matched with a spinning star trail background. That was just
awesome. Yeah.
That was really neat. Drew, have you ever entered a photo in a competition?
I'll tell you what, I'm not into, there's sites that post my photos on. If they win, they win. If they don't, they don't. I'm not really in the hobby or my passion to win anything. It's always, secondary in my mind. I do it for my satisfaction and, to share my pictures and the night sky with others. But no, I really haven't. I really haven't made an objective to, hey, I want to win this contest or whatever, but it is what it is. And if they do come across, I have had a few publications and NASA last year or the year before, I think it was 2021, recognized one of my images as their
APOD,
which is, which is a photography photo of the day, which was awesome.
Yeah. That's incredible.
I'll throw my images around and so be it. If they win, they win, but it's always secondary in my book. I enjoy it for the passion and just seeing, what my data transpires to come to.
Yeah, no doubt. Did you have any favorites from this competition? Did you see any ones in there that really caught your eye?
See the photographs of this competition, but I did see, I think it was National Geographic's photo competition. I think it was that. And there was this image that was the sound representation of a black hole. It was kind of cool. Because they used, I believe it was water. It won the conceptual prize and it was really cool. I really liked that. So I haven't quite looked at the competition for the dark skies. Probably should.
We won't tell Betty Maya. Don't worry. He'll be good.
Okay, good.
So do you do any landscape photos? Do you do any, go out to Joshua Tree and try and get the Milky Way? Do anything like that?
Well, I have started to peak. It's piquing my interest because I'm being surrounded by it. And I did used to do photography like about 13 years ago. So I still have my old 2009 DSLR. So I was
You probably have the same Rebel that Drew started.
Right.
So I'm kind of interested in it. I need to learn. I need someone to really show me what's going on. Cause I was very much an amateur when it came to photography. So maybe potentially in the future.
Well, when you go out there, we got some great captions. So I stumbled across this. This is a random website that appears to just be letting AI generate everything. And AI came up with these exceptional captions. And you got to tell me which one or any of them you like using. So next time you go out, say, it's a crazy, incredible, Perseid meteor shower with the Milky Way out at Joshua Tree, maybe underneath your Instagram post, gazing at infinity in the dark. Or how about in the darkness, we find our true light. I want to thank my guests this night and Drew Evans for bearing with me on those horrible Instagram captions right there. Thank you so much for joining me today. I had a ton of fun with you guys. I hope you did as well. I really appreciate, you guys coming on here and spending some time with me. As a reminder, you can find the links to this show and more over at lightpollutionnews.com. I'm your host, Bill McGinney, helping to shed the light only where it's needed. Have a great and spooky October, everyone.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you again.